This is the title on the official brochure. It was How Creation Science Impacts the Person. This was a title that Bob gave me, and so I designed a talk around it. So just show of hands, how many people were at my talk last year? Okay, a couple, good.
What was the title of it?
Post-flood biblical history. How many people have attended the IBI class that on the creation? Okay, good. So what we're going to go through today, for those of you who remember last year, I kind of just sprayed everyone with a fire hose of information for the entire time. It's not going to be quite that bad this time, but you'll still see a lot of information, and some of it you may have seen before, but others you have not, because during this topic. So who am I? I'm not an elder or deacon or anything. But I am. I was born in Knoxville, Tennessee, raised around the suburb of Farragut, named after the admiral who was raised himself around there. I've got a bachelor's in mathematics and physics from the University of Tennessee, and then I went on to get a master's and a PhD in applied mathematics from the North Carolina State University. I wrote a book, or co-authored a book. You can find it on Amazon. It's sold dozens of copies. Transionospheric Synthetic Aperture Imaging. If you ever have trouble falling asleep, you can read this book. It'll put you to sleep. Currently, I work at the radar division at the Naval Research Lab, and I basically help improve radar performance prediction for over-the-horizon radar. I'm the lone mathematician there, and amongst a bunch of engineers in my group. Also, sometimes I like to grow a beard and dress up like a first century Jew. You can see the remnants of that right now. You may have seen me sing in the choir. I'm a second tenor there. I'm currently on sabbatical. My wife and I had a baby last November, and we can't really do anything anymore. If on Emmanuel's YouTube page, if you go all the way back to 2017, you can see me and a couple of other people ramble on and on about climate change. We had like over 300 people in attendance that day. It was fun. And then on April 10th, 2021, I married my wife, Yanni, and we had a son, Izariah, who was born on November 6th. Neither of whom could be here today. So, first slide, what is creation science? And now I'm just going to open it up and see if any of you have a definition.
I'm going to have a guess. I'll guess.
Okay.
Correlation between what the Bible says and what are the evidence in science.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, basically, anybody else want
to? Genesis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not evolution.
Yes. basically, it's taking looking at science from the biblical perspective. You get a lot, that's something that's kind of, it's almost radical in today's mindset in our culture, but God formed the universe. He is the master scientist. And so, one of the famous, I believe it's Kepler, I want to say, it's just like learning science is just thinking, research of science is thinking God's thoughts after him. In a sense. So creation science, you basically look at everything from a different perspective. You see what's in, your foundation is in the Bible. The Bible is truth. And so therefore anything that we see in the natural world must align with the Bible. And if not, then if it doesn't, then that means you've got incorrect data, you're looking at something wrong. My story, since this is personal, how creation science impacts the person, I thought I'd tell a little bit about myself here. I was, like I said in those first slides, I grew up in the suburbs of Knoxville, Tennessee. I went to a big, I guess you'd call it a mega church, big Southern Baptist church, First Baptist Concord is the name of it. Grew up there, the great preacher there when I was growing up, but most of the time we stayed in the New Testament. a lot of times. Didn't really stray too much from that. Or just even if in the Old Testament, some of the major big stories, like you might have mentioned something about Jonah or something about King David or whatever. That wasn't that much. Now, he did, a claim to fame in that church was Vacation Bible School, and they went way over the top doing really fantastical productions involving laser light shows from companies in Las Vegas and things like that. But so they did display some of the stories, like the flood and stuff. It made the whole sanctuary look like it was underwater and things like that. But it didn't really get into much of, it was never brought up really, like in a lot of churches, science and all that. But when I went to a public schools, and in my public schools when I was a freshman, I took a class called Bible History. This was in a public school, and it was a believer, and he managed to sneak in, make a class about the Bible by just saying it's a history class. That was his little way of getting in, which is kind of cool. I doubt you could even do something like that today. But with his class, I just learned a lot of stuff in the Old Testament I never heard of before. We never went over all the kings list and everything. And so it was just kind of opened my eyes. I'm like, well, there's a lot more in the Bible than what I've been taught in church. I did, by the way, I was a believer in, it was around sixth grade, I did become a believer at the church there. So I was a believer, I just didn't know a lot of this, what was in the Bible. Fast forward, and so I never really had much passion for things. Youth group was not really my thing. This is late 90s, early 2000s. Every worship service was like a rock concert. I don't like loud music. Even if a drummer is not in a cage, I get a pounding headache from it. So I never went to any of the youth group stuff, hardly, maybe a couple of summer camps, but that was it. Now, junior year, I had a friend who started a creation club after school. It was hosted by the ROTC teacher at the time, who went to our church. And I went basically to the club to support him. And I was started some seeing watching some videos and things, and I was like, I've never seen this before. Beforehand, I was almost like, even with the Bible history class I was taught, when we brought up the subject of Adam and Eve and the science, I knew that it contradicted, but there was like in my mind, it was like in the back of my mind somewhere, and I never confronted it fully. And I was like, well, maybe Adam and Eve were all hairy and something. I didn't know. But this creation club really opened my eyes, and he handed out specifically the old copies of what this magazine called Creation Magazine. It was put out by Answers in Genesis, and now it's put out by Creation Ministries International, which kind of they're breaking apart of the ministry, and they form two ministries now. And I had put it in a drawer somewhere. I'd never really thought much about it. The following summer, in between my junior and senior year of high school, my grandma died. This was my first experience with anybody dying that I was close to, really. And I remember, I knew she was a believer and all that, but I remember just kind of, you're still kind of a melancholy in knowing that she's gone, because it happened suddenly. And the week following her death, I just stumbled upon this old copy of the Creation Magazine that was given to me by the teacher. And I started flipping through it. And then I was like, whoa, I had not heard any of this before. And I noticed they had a website, Answers in Genesis, so I went there, and I just started just absorbing everything on the website, just hundreds and thousands of articles, reading that, and I was like, I finally have something I can be passionate about. And it's bolstered my faith really a lot, because it's something I could relate to, in a sense. I was so excited to tell my friend who started the Creation Club about all this, but he was on a mission trip to China that summer, so I couldn't talk to him. But it came back the senior year, I got to be the president of the club. And ever since then, if you look in my senior year, high school yearbook, for those of us who made 4.0 or above, they asked, like, what do we want to do with a career? And I put creation scientist on that. And I went through, I want to do science. I won't get into the rest of this, but my career doesn't let me do much in terms of this, but I do get, at IBC, I get to teach the IBI class and things like this. And then I have an entire two bookcases full of creation books that I just absorb everything in them. So that's my story and how I kind of got into all this. Now, what I wanted to get to for the rest of this is the concept called biblical glasses. This is something that Ken Ham, who's he's a big name in the creation world, uses. It's basically looking at everything through the lens of Scripture. As I said before, if something that you see in the world doesn't line up with what's in the Bible, it's not the Bible that's wrong. And so your starting foundation has to go with that. So you look at everything through these biblical glasses, and everything, and the world will make so much more sense when you look at that. I'm going to get some examples here. Say geology, for example. You hear that the way that these different layers in the earth are formed is that over millions of years, the silt and sand builds up slowly, and then another period comes along, and there's more, and it builds up slowly and slowly until you get a millions of years worth of a timeline. Say, if you go to the Grand Canyon, you'll see that all over the place. But what's interesting is there's places that doesn't match up with that framework. For instance, look at the rock here. Notice anything weird about it?
Zigzag.
Yeah. Now, if these layers have supposedly been there for millions of years while the other ones are built on top of that, can you bend solid rock? No. Solid rock breaks. So what this tells you is that this entire sequence here had to have been built while it was still in a very short amount of time, and while it was still soft, this tectonic activity came around and warped it and bent it while the entire thing was still soft and pliable. So that tells you right there that there's something wrong with what they normally tell in science classes. This is actually in near Dublin, Ireland, where this example is. Another one, this is in New Mexico. Sometimes you can get really subtle here. Look at this curve going through here. This is folded gyprock. This is Penhalt Cliff east of Milute, Cornwall. Another one. Look at how jagged and some of these, it almost goes vertical. This one zigzags this way, and then it zigzags this way around. There's something very weird going on here that they're not just gradually being laid over time. For a closer example, how many of you have driven through I-68 in Western Maryland? Okay, good. One. This is a big cutout they did of the interstate there, Sideline Hill. Notice the layers of the mountain there. What are they doing? Yeah, they're bowing. This is due to they were all laid down very quickly, and then the tectonic activity came around that formed the Appalachian Mountains and was able to bend these, and so it looks like you get this weird sagging thing here. This is a pretty awesome thing to drive through. It's one of the most spectacular cutouts in the country in the interstate system. So if you ever want to go out to Western Maryland and see that, it's cool. Also, one of these things too is, notice how in these previous slides how sharp the layers are in between each other. What does usually when dirt and soil and stuff is put down, what happens over time? Yes, but it does. But if it's just left out in the open,
it weathers.
Yes, there's no evidence of erosion in between any of these layers. They're razor edge, so that there was no time for erosion. They had to be done very quickly. Other things that might indicate that these layers are not laid down as over long periods of time is what they call polystrate tree trunks. These are actually fossilized tree trunks, not fossilized trees, just the trunks, as if they were somehow ripped out of their foundation and deposited many times upside down, and they tend to go through multiple layers in the rocks. Now, I doubt that these trees were just sitting there dead for millions of years waiting for the rock to be built up around them. That seems a bit unreasonable. So that means another evidence that these were layered quickly. Here's some more examples from Tennessee. I'm from Tennessee. I haven't found these yet. I think I know sort of where they are. But yeah, and so this is just geology looking at example, again, through the biblical lens. If you look at geology all around you, you can see every time you go, these rock layers, what in the Bible could have actually created these layers?
The flood.
The flood, yes. So every time you see, you drive past rocks and you see layers, you are looking at direct evidence of Noah's flood in the Bible. So this is something in the Bible you can see in your everyday occurrence as, whoa, this is something God did. It's right there in front of us. Other things I want to say, in terms of fossils, you get the impression that an animal dies, it sinks to the bottom of some lake or whatever, and then slowly gets covered with sediment over time. Out of experience, or even when something dies, do you just see random skeletons laying around in the woods somewhere? No. Scavengers are, even in lakes, scavengers are going to come, completely rip the thing apart, and you're never going to see it full. And fossils can form very quickly, as these examples from the June 10th, 1886 eruption of Mount Tarawera in New Zealand. We have fun things like, here's some petrified ham, a petrified bag of flour. These, they think it's either medicine or lamp fuel, whatever these are. And there's a petrified bowler hat. Probably be pretty heavy to wear now. But they're made out of solid rock. Very fast fossils. Here's another from a mine in Tasmania, a hat that's now made of solid calcium carbonate. Fossils can form very, very quickly, given the right conditions. Here's some fossilized butter found in a bog in Ireland. What I like about the right one there, they think it's about 1,000 years old. The top is solid rock, but if you take the rock out of that, there's still butter there. I wouldn't want to try to eat that, personally, but I guess you could. But the top part is turned into fossils.
And you mean underneath the fossil, there's soft?
Still soft butter from probably about 1,000 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Butter lasts a long time. So that was a little bit about fossils. Get into a little bit more in a bit. We're going to move into biology. Now, to show you just how looking through biblical glass is an easy example. Which of these things is not like the other?
The landscape.
The cow.
Yeah. You hear all the time that you have these different species. You have a horse is a species, a donkey is a species, zebra is a species. That's a picture I took, actually. And then you have, this is Scottish Highland cow, is another species. But what's interesting, you intuitively were able to see which of these is not like the other, the cow.
What is that thing in the bottom middle? That's different than everything.
This is the background.
Background of what?
The slide.
Slideshow.
Yeah. But basically, what we see here, if you combine a horse and a donkey, you get a mule. If you combine, you can actually combine a donkey and a zebra, and you get something called, I've heard various things, I like to refer to them as Z-donks.
I thought music.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is actually Z-donk. You can also call them, I think there's another word for it, I forget. It combines the other word for donkey that I'm not going to say here. But basically, and this gets into a concept we're going to get into in a minute, but let me do it to another one of these slides. Which of these things is not like the other?
The dog.
Yeah, the dog. This was my cat. That was Higelac. We have here a jaguar and a lion, and then here's a Boston Terrier. Now, intuitively, you know that these three are cats, even though they're different species. That's a very large cat. This is also a large cat with pretty coloring, and this was my cat who was very large for a house cat. But now, if you try to combine, you can combine different types of cats. I don't think you can't breed a house cat with a lion, but you can breed different things like a lion and a tiger together. You get a liger. And other things, and there's a chain that goes around that you can connect all the cat types together. If you tried to breed a cat and a dog together, you get something like this. That's not going to work. They have nowhere to go to the bathroom, for instance. And so basically the key here is that, put a bunch of verses in here. And all through Genesis, before the flood, you get this word in kind, biblical kind, where it says, God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, according to each according to its kind. Again, you hear here that the God created the great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters teemed according to their kinds, and every bird of flight after its kind. Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, and so on. A lot of people see that and you just assume, well, kind must mean species or something. That is not actually what the word kind means. It's the term species was is more of a modern science development. Kind, in effect, what we saw intuitively on these previous slides is there's a horse kind, which equine, which the donkey and the zebra belong to, because you can actually breed things within the same kind together. Sometimes not always, but if they can breed with each other, that means they're in the same kind. Just like the cats can breed with each other to a certain extent, they're in the same kind, but you can never breed a cat with a dog. Different kind. And so basically, with a few exceptions in either direction, coming with the modern science, the kind is probably more at the family level, if you're familiar with biology class and the way that the hierarchy goes. So there was only one horse kind originally that God created, one dog kind, one cat kind, etc. And how this differs is, according to evolution, we have this tree of life that branches out from some pond scum down here, and branches eventually you get different creatures that go about. But in the creation method, it's actually the creation orchard. God created a bunch of kinds and he pre-programmed them with genetic information in their cells that they can, when they reproduce, their different offspring could show different traits over and over again. If you have two dogs, for example, with medium length coats, you can, when they come together, some of their puppies are going to have long fur, some of them are going to have short fur, some of them are going to have medium fur, because the information was there in the parents to begin with. You couldn't see it. It's just the way the genetics works. And so you get all these kinds, but if you separate them over time, if you get, say, two dogs with long fur and they have puppies, they're only going to produce long fur puppies because that's all they have. The genes are all that's there. And they get separated over time. And eventually you can get different species that way if the changes are enough where they can't mate with the parent population enough. They call them different species, but the definition of species is very loose in modern science if you read the literature. But this is, they can still sometimes go with other, mate with other members of the kind. So we have this orchard branching out. And here it is. Like I said, the kind is usually at the family level. Species, genus, family. Sometimes it can be either at the genus or the order. And so people wonder about like Noah's Ark. How do they fit? There's like millions of species of animals on the planet. How do they all fit in the ark? They did not. He just had to take each different kinds. You can see here, this is just an estimate based on a couple of different studies of what was on the ark, how many animals were needed. For instance, with mammals, the current estimate is that they probably only needed about 239 pairs of mammals on the ark, compared to the 5,500 current species of mammals. And you get birds, about 299, reptiles, about 321, amphibians, 70. Now, the sea animals and little creepy crawly things were not listed on the animals that were on the ark. Sea animals for obvious reasons, and the little insects for different reason, they're actually not considered alive in the biblical sense. It has to do with the Hebrew terminology there. But obviously they are alive, but life means a slightly different thing the way the Bible defines it. But overall, obviously, there's probably a few stowaways, little spiders building webs in the ark and things like that. But so overall, there were probably only about 938 different, that's obviously specific, but something around there, different pairs of animals. The ark was massive. It could easily fit that. And so you didn't have to worry, like people wonder if the ark was not big enough. Oh, yeah, it was. Now we're going to move into a little bit of astronomy. I'm just kind of going through various topics to show you the biblical glasses. This is looking at astronomy specifically in our solar system. things that supposedly, what, the Earth was supposedly 4.6 billion years. Now, and they tell you that the solar system was around that too. But there's a lot of things in the solar system that don't match up with that data. In fact, every single planet has something weird about it that shows that it doesn't match up. Mercury has actually, it's got a magnetic field that's very, very rapidly decreasing. Between the measurements of the original probes back in the 60s and 70s to when they were finally able, the Mariner probe, and they were finally able to send something about 10 years ago to Mercury, they were amazed at how much its magnetic field had decreased. There was a creationist, Russell Humphreys, actually predicted this decrease many years before it was discovered, based on a model that he created out of everything in the universe initially being made out of water, which you see is the case in Genesis 1-2. He actually slightly under-predicted the rate of decrease. But Mercury also, it's as close to the sun as you can get in our solar system, but it has ice in places. And you'd think that even in the daytime there, it's hot enough to melt lead. So it's kind of an interesting little thing. But this magnetic field, if it's been around for a long time, there's no way we'd still even, and it's decreasing this fast, there's no way we would ever have seen a magnetic field on it. Venus actually rotates in retrograde, which means it goes backwards compared to the other planets in its rotation. And it goes against the nebular hypothesis, supposedly how our solar system formed. But it's also very, very chemically different than Earth, even though it's supposedly our twin planet. And thus it should have been formed by the same materials if it was formed naturally. Under all those clouds, Venus is bright because you're staring at bright clouds made of sulfuric acid. But under all those clouds, it's a very, very fresh-looking surface. It has not been around for a while. Mars has got abundant evidence of past water-based water there that apparently some sort of catastrophe happened, and it's got heavy volcano. It's so funny because you'll see everyone, there's evidence of all this Mars, and maybe Mars had a big flood in the past. They say that about Mars, a planet that currently has no water, and yet we have a planet that's 70% water. And they say, oh, there's no way there could have ever been a global flood here. Also, Mars has two tiny moons. They're probably captured asteroids. They're very, very unstable orbits. They're going to eventually crash into the planet if God lets them keep going. So they couldn't have been there long. Jupiter, the big king of the planets, it has argon, xenon, and krypton in very high concentrations that cannot be explained by the evolutionary models currently. And the accretion disk model of how they think gas planets like Jupiter formed said it should have a large rocky core with about 20 to 30 times the mass of Earth. In reality, from what they can tell, Jupiter's core is about 6 times Earth's max at maximum, and it may not even exist. It may just be a giant ball of gas there. So the core accretion model, which is what they teach in the science textbooks, it can't even account for Jupiter's existence. Jupiter should not exist. Jupiter has a bunch of moons, too. Io is far too hot for it to exist as long as it has. It should have cooled off just by heat loss over the years. Jupiter does squeeze it some, but that can't account for all of it. The biggest moon, Ganymede, has a very weak magnetic field. When the magnetic fields are supposedly created by this dynamo theory, that is what they say, but it should have frozen long, long ago because Ganymede is so tiny compared to other planets. Saturn, what do we know about, what's the big thing about Saturn everyone knows about?
Rings.
Yes, they're very bright and they're shiny and they're new looking, even according to evolutionists, because they're made of ice. They're little tiny ice particles and they're so delicate they would actually disappear within decades if they weren't constantly being resupplied by the moon Enceladus. But you think the moon's only going to have a finite reservoir of the ice it can shoot at it, so how long is that supposed to go on? The rings are very young. They couldn't have been there for long. Also, Saturn's magnetic field perfectly aligns with its spin axis, which the dynamo theory does not allow. And Saturn is even less dense than Jupiter. You could actually, if you had an ocean of water, Saturn would actually float that you could put it in, big enough. Saturn has a moon called Titan that's an atmosphere made of methane. At the very, very upper limit, it could only have existed for 10 million years. That's the upper limit, as opposed to like the 4.6 billion supposedly has. Uranus, which I'm pronouncing that way, rolls around on its side along with its rings and moons. It shows the evidence that supposedly why it rolls around to the side, it says sometime in the past it was hit by some sort of gigantic object that tilted it over and it just rolled around. But there's no evidence for that other than that, and it wouldn't explain why the moon's orbit that way anyway. Even stranger, its magnetic field is tilted 60 degrees with respect to its axis, very way off. And that was a surprise to everyone, but again, Russell Humphreys, this creationist, he predicted that the strength of the magnetic field 2 years before it was discovered. He was the only one, based on a model that he developed from the book of Genesis. And then the moon Miranda, one of Uranus's moons, is one of the strangest objects in the solar system, and it completely defies all evolutionary explanations. I'm going to leave it there and let you look it up if you're curious. Neptune has winds that reach almost 1,300 miles per hour. That's quite a hurricane storm. It's got storms that are constantly changing. Neptune is weird because it generates heat. Most of its heat comes from inside of it instead of the sun. It's so far out. And it radiates. Russell Humphreys correctly predicted its magnetic field based on a recent creation, but it should not even exist in the first place based on the evolutionary models. And then one of its moons, Triton, has water volcanoes that shoot up. And the heat source for that cannot be explained by what we currently see going on. Its orbit is almost perfectly circular. There's no tidal forces there. And it's actually orbiting backwards. But I just want going through this astronomy just to show you that looking through the biblical glasses from the Bible, stuff that we see in science that scientists say, well, we don't really know why this is. If you look at the Bible, there's perfect explanations for it. Science, the Bible can make scientific predictions. I didn't want to leave off Pluto here because some people are still mad Pluto's not a planet anymore. It's rapidly losing nitrogen, about 500 tons of it every hour, but it has an atmosphere that shouldn't exist if it's been there for a long time. It's got very fresh looking ice. It's got glaciers and 1,000 foot high ice mountains. Most of the surface has very few craters. I mean, it's active. Pluto is active. Its moon, Charon, shows signs of resurfacing with 3 to 6 mile deep canyons, but it's so tiny it should not have any heat source whatsoever by now, but apparently it still does because it hasn't been there very long. Comets themselves are evidence for a young creation because they burn up very quickly, and there's no evidence of where they come from. The Oort cloud is just a figment of somebody's imagination, if you've heard of that. Now I'm going to get into another topic, history, showing you from the Bible, looking through the biblical lens, how things make so much more sense and how it can really affect you in your personal life as you just see these topics and like, oh, God did this. Yeah.
Sorry for the interruption.
Yeah.
But for the data set on astronomy, just that alone, how do the evolutionists respond to that data set?
Well, they keep coming up with theories that might work, but then they can do for like one planet, but then it doesn't work for the others. Most of these planets, their common source is, well, something came along in the past, some giant object, and hit the planet, and that causes what's weird about it. And it's just like a convenient scapegoat they go to, but there's no evidence of those impacts. Yeah?
I came in late. Do you have references or in your presentation somewhere?
I do not have references in book form, but I can point you to some websites right now. Yeah. Yes. I want to get into a little bit now of history and the languages. The languages in the world, try as they might, linguists you would assume from evolutionary standpoint, everybody come out of Africa or whatever, and you could trace language history back to one source. That's never been able to be done. Instead, what we see are multiple language families that are completely unrelated to each other. What in the Bible could have caused that? Yep. many of these families can be broken down into subfamilies where you get languages that were people separated enough, but you can tell that the populations had a common source back in the day. For instance, Indo-European, which we all speak, English is in the Indo-European branch, but it has 8 different surviving subfamilies: Albanian, Armenian, Balto-Slavic, Celtic, Germanic, Hellenic, Indo-Iranian, and Italic. And then there's anywhere from 2 to 9 that are now extinct. The people that spoke them were wiped out, or the languages themselves were wiped out. All of the subfamilies within a family can be shown to be related to one another, but not to any outside the family. Some of these languages are very, in these groups, are very, very different from each other, but they still share some similarities, like most notably, in, you can see it in the numbers or just random words like words for cow or something like that. Always looks, you could see that there's some sort of relation there. Or simple words like mom and dad. But if you get outside that, like say one of the Asian languages like Chinese, they're completely different. Now, I do want to, you can think of this as a bit of an analogy to the biological kinds, but it is different here because while the language kinds can, in a sense, mate with each other and you get new languages made from ones that are totally different families, an example being Yiddish. Yiddish mainly comes from a Germanic language, mainly German and Hebrew, which Hebrew is not part of the Indo-European family. For anyone who studies this, you would know that. It's very different. Now, that's just a little bit about the Tower of Babel and timelines, I mean, and languages. Timelines, if you go into history, there's a number of factors in the dating ancient civilizations, but all of the very, very oldest seem to have just poofed into existence at around the same time. And you would think that there were, if the people have been there for hundreds of thousands of years, civilizations, depending on how well good the area was, you'd see a lot more different time differential between the civilizations coming up. But no, they just all appear all of a sudden. And again, why is that?
The flood.
Yes, but something after that. I heard someone say it. Babel. Yeah. God separated everybody. They went their own way. And therefore, you have all these people groups, and they can start civilizations at the same time based on the knowledge that their particular group took with them. There's a great timeline that I recommend. You can actually buy it in the IBC bookstore here. It's by Sebastian Adams. It unfolds to like 20 feet long or more. And it's very fun to look at. Now, post-Babel, if you look through this, your biblical glasses, it's clear that everyone is descended from those on the ark, the eight people on the ark. So the history of every people group, there was a time when they knew God at some point. For most of the groups, that knowledge got distorted or just completely lost over time, some of them more quickly than others. But God knew that was going to happen. So he specifically revealed more of himself to Abraham and his descendants. So we could have somebody, there could be a true record somewhere. But there were other cultures that clung on to what they knew and passed it down through the generations. A biblical example of this would be Job. Job was most likely not a descendant of Abraham. We don't get any indication of that. He existed probably around the same time as the patriarch, and we know he's not a descendant because one of his friends is actually listed as being a people group that was one of the descendants of Abraham. A lot of people don't kind of miss that detail. But there's others in the Bible. Job is a good example in the Bible. There's other cultures around the world that we see this. But we get this, Romans 1:20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, both his external and power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. People everywhere know little bits of God, whether it's from cultural memory or otherwise, just seeing creation around them. But here's some examples of the biblical truth that were remembered in cultures, like, for instance, China. A lot of you have seen, if you've seen me talk before, you've seen this. The Chinese symbols for boat, for boat, are actually the combination of vessel and eight and people. How many people were on the ark?
Eight.
To covet or to desire are the symbols two trees plus women. And that makes to covet or desire. To create is speak plus dust or mind plus life plus walk. That is create. Complete or finish as two plus person, which equals first. And then you get first plus home, which is equal to complete. There were two people at the beginning. Forbidden or to warn is literally two trees plus God. And then the symbol for garden is dust plus breath plus two persons plus enclosure. So they remembered little bits of Genesis there of their true history from the very beginning. Another one, the word for tempter is actually secret plus man plus garden plus alive is equal to the devil. Devil plus trees plus cover is equal to the tempter. So just fun facts. China, they also kept other things. they kept actually traditions for millennia about God's true nature and how to worship Him properly. They actually had a Day of Atonement, just like you would see prescribed in the Bible, except it was the emperor who would act as the high priest, offering a sacrifice for both his sins and the sins of his people. They knew about God having the natural attributes of being sovereign, eternal, immutable, all-powerful, all-knowing, ever-present, and infinite, as well as His moral attributes of being love, holy, full of grace, faithful, good, merciful, compassionate, just, righteous, and wise. And I can give you the source for all this. There's a book, if you're curious. They also, if you look in the royal astronomical records, they recorded a star of Bethlehem when it appeared. They saw it. And 3 hours of darkness that happened a little over 30 years later. That obviously they freaked out about. Other places knew that God is triune in different cultures. For instance, the earliest Egyptians knew something of the Trinity is seen as a carving in an ivory comb of a king Zet, but there's also preserved in Psalms written and known to the true God, which they called Aton. You could read the text of these Psalms, and they look like they belong in the book of Psalms, like, O God alone, beside whom there is no other. When the fledgling and the egg chirps in the shell, thou givest him breath therein to preserve him alive. Ancient Egyptians wrote in King James. When thou hast brought him together to the point of bursting in the egg, he cometh forth from the egg to chirp with all his might. He goeth about on his 2 feet when he hath come forth therefrom. And O God alone, beside whom there is no other, how manifold all thy works. They actually have these... Very ancient Egypt, they have these psalms written to God as they remembered Him. Another one, like there's another one with the excerpt, How excellent are thy designs, O Lord of eternity. Other cultures, the ancient Indians remembered Japheth as their progenitor, as they knew him as Prajapati, or Father Japheth. They saw him as the creator of all things, as a sort of trinity. So they got things a little confused there. The ancient Hawaiians knew that the Creator is a triune Godhead with three persons called them Kane, Ku, and Lono. This was referred to as Hikapoloa Oe, which means the most excellent one. The three of them is one. There's a couple of books that are really good for that talks about it. The ancient Saxons thought of the Creator as a trinity, either as Odin, Vila, and Vilas, or Odin, Hörner, and Loder. But the real Odin was actually a descendant of Japheth. He came about 16 or 17 generations later in the 5th or 4th century B.C. He migrated north with his people from Asgard, which literally is the word Asia Garden. It's modern-day Turkey. It's not a weird planet out in space somewhere like in the Marvel Universe. The Incans remembered the Creator as the Trinity Viracocha Emayamana Viracocha and Tokopo Viracocha, although they thought that the latter two were the sons of the first, but yet still as powerful. And then the Mayans knew the Godhead as Kalhua, Hurricane, Chipi Kalhula, and Raksa Kalhula. They remembered the pre-creation counsels of God. Let us make man in our image. So just a little tidbit. Some cultures did remember what they knew from the beginning. With that, we get flood legends. Everybody's descended from Adam and Eve and the layer Noah and his family, so every culture on earth has a flood legend. Some of them, they would remember more things than others. One of my favorite ones, which I brought up last year, is the Toltecs. They recorded that there were 1,716 years from creation to the flood, which is about 50 years off from what you would get in the book of Genesis. Then men were destroyed by tremendous rains and lightning from the sky, and all the land, with no exception, and was covered and submerged by water up to 15 cubits, or whatever that unit is, deep. A few survived the flood in what they call a closed chest. After they had multiplied, they erected a tower of great height in order to take refuge if the world was flooded again. But at that point, their languages were confused, and they went their separate ways, scattering all over the earth. The Toltecs, who came from seven friends with their wives, who all spoke the same language, after this event, they passed great land and seas. They lived in caves and endured great hardships along their journey, finally reaching what would be their homeland in Central America after 104 years of wandering and 520 years after the flood. They also recorded once later in their history there was a day when the sun stood still in its place without moving. as in the book of Joshua. What's cool, you might think of that, oh, they just heard what some missionaries said and they just copied it and made it their own. Well, there's a problem with that, is that the Toltecs vanished 400 years before the Spanish got there. But they left behind written records and that a small number of people could still read when they discovered, because they spoke the same language. The guy who originally translated this kept scoffing at it because he was like, this is stupid, because in his culture they didn't have anything like this. But look how well it matches up with what's in the Bible. Most cultures, the memories of the flood were lost. Some only remembered there was a flood, that their ancestors took refuge on a tall mountain or a weird tall tree that grew above the waters or something. But they did remember there was a flood and a tall place that people were able to go. But sometimes they kept other interesting details. The tribes indigenous to New York State had a tradition that the Atlantic Ocean once overflowed its banks because of a tremendous flood. But the people that had received advanced tidings of the subject from the Great Spirit, which enabled them to save themselves and their chosen animals and birds by ascending to the summit of Tower House, now known as Mount Marcy. That's the highest point in the Adirondack Mountains and the only one that was supposedly not submerged by this flood. All of their human enemies, which were races of gigantic white and yellow men who were constantly at war with them, and the huge serpentine sea and land animals, Batwing and Griffinclawed, which preyed on them, were all drowned. On what they calculated as the 4,000th anniversary of this event, the people gathered from all over the region in many different tribes on the slope of Mount Marcy to hold appropriate exercises of thanksgiving and observance. A powerful chief named Wildcat from the upper valley of, which I think is the west branch of the Susquehanna River, from what I can tell, he was known as a very powerful orator, and his knowledge, he was the keynote speaker at this occasion. 4,000 years from the flood would be around the year 1653. There was no record from any of the Europeans settling at the time of this, which means they didn't know about it. But it probably was a pretty cool event to have been there, celebrating 4,000 years since the flood. Now, moving on, I want to get to some more in history. The nations that we see from the you can look at through the biblical lens, they do have some other garbled memories, but the royal genealogies of many of these nations go back to Noah or one of his children, and this is before any missionaries got there. Examples, the Irish people have always traced themselves back to Magog, who was the son of Japheth. The Hmong, also called Miaozu people of China, trace their ancestry back to Gomen, or Gomer, whose father was Japu, and whose uncles were Lo Han and Lo Shin, as in Ham and Shem. Gomen's grandfather was named Nua, and if you go back several generations before that, the first man was called Dirt.
Dirt?
What does Adam mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
Really?
Yep. These records exist from times before there was any Christian influence. Now, the personal impact in all this, going back to what the title of the lecture is that some believers, especially those new in the faith, may enjoy history, but are reluctant to study it because of facts that contradict the Bible. I was kind of in this boat when I was in high school. I just didn't want to, my mind was conflicting, and I didn't want to, wasn't sure what to do before I learned all this stuff. Like you hear, because you hear about primitive people living in caves for eons or dates of founding of the earliest civilizations that don't fit in with the Bible. But, much like science, any true history must line up with what is in the Bible. And if you do deeper research instead of just believing what's normally taught, that is exactly what you're going to find. So studying history, it should be a bolster to one's faith, not weaken it. You see things that contradict the Bible, it shouldn't bring doubts in your mind. You should be like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Wanting to get into a bit of dragons or dinosaurs, it's always a popular topic. So basically, creation science can help a person see that two seemingly different topics are one and the same. For instance, dragons, they're featured in legend and stories from cultures around the world as usually large reptilian and sometimes fire-breathing just giant monsters. Stories abound of this heroic knight slaying the troublesome dragons to save the fair maidens and whatnot. Dinosaurs are extinct reptilian creatures, some of which grew to enormous proportions. Their fossils are found all over the world, and they supposedly died out 65 million years ago, well before humans came on the scene. Now, legends tend to be based on nuggets of truth. Behind every legend is something that really happened, usually. Even the tiniest bit of truth that may be buried in there. So maybe dragons were real. Is there any proof of that? Yes. The reasons we don't find any dragon remains around is because of this guy right here. He was Sir Richard Owen. He was the superintendent of the Natural History Department of the British Museum. He was a believer, and he was a very staunch creationist and a very fierce critic of Darwin in the day. So much so that Darwin actually wrote a letter to his buddy Huxley saying, talking about this guy, saying, "I am burning with indignation. I could not get to sleep until past 3 last night for indigestion." Because this guy could keep combating what he was saying. Before that all happened, though, in 1841, he coined the term dinosaur, meaning terrible lizard, to describe the fossils that were constantly being found during that time. Before that, they were simply known as dragon fossils. He just gave them a new name, just for simplicity. His new term stuck, but dragon and dinosaur were actually, if you read the paleontology literature from the day, dragon and dinosaur were used interchangeably for a long time. They're not anymore, but he invented the word dinosaur. Now, Noah took representatives of all air-breathing vertebrates on the ark. Dinosaurs were air-breathing vertebrates. Therefore, there's logic here. What's the conclusion? Yes. Here's an example of one, a reconstruction of what one might look like that just happened to look like a dinosaur that looks a lot like a dragon. In fact, the scientific name for this is Drekorex hogswartzia.
Could you explain that first bullet?
Yeah.
Noah took representatives of all breathing vertebrates on the ark as what?
As to save them from the flood. He just took them on. He took them onto the ark.
So, did it include dragons?
Yes.
Dinosaurs?
Yes.
And which one is the one that's identified in the Bible?
Well, there are identified in the Bible. The Bible, you'll see the word dragon pop up occasionally, because remember the word dinosaur did not exist until the 1840s.
But the dragon is I see is in Revelations.
Yes.
Analogies with Satan.
Exactly. In a mythological sense, there's also a word that's used in the Old Testament throughout. It's mostly in modern Bibles that is translated as jackal. But in reality, there's two different words being confused here, tanin and tanim. Tanin is actually the Hebrew word for dragon. Tanim is the Hebrew word for jackals, plural. They get conflated by translators a lot, and they just assume that it all means jackals. But if you look at them, a lot of times, especially the ones in the water-based ones, it is not the word for jackal, it is the word for dragon. It's just translated wrong in most modern Bibles.
What about Leviathan?
Leviathan, yes. Leviathan was a real creature. It's spoken of in more of a, like you said, almost a demonic sense elsewhere in the Bible, but in the book of Job, it is talked about as this giant creature. It could breathe fire, and so according to the Bible, but everything else about it doesn't. It's not supernatural. It had really strong plates. I didn't put the slides on here, but we found fossils of creatures that match up perfectly with the description of Leviathan. They were giant crocodilian type animals. Some of them had they had plates. There were armors as big as that looked like shields, literally woven very tight together where nothing could pierce, as is described in the Bible.
What about Jonah, Leviathan?
Okay, Jonah, Leviathan is never mentioned, but in fact, the word for the book of Jonah is just described, in the book of Jonah, the creature is just described as big fish. But that's a generic term meaning anything that can live in the water. Jesus himself actually specified what the creature was. He, in talking about it in the book of Matthew, he used the term, when he brings his analogy between himself and Jonah, He actually uses the Greek word katos. Katos is a word, it does not mean any type of fish. It does not mean any type of whale. It was a word specifically known as a type of creature not very well known in the Mediterranean at that time that we would refer to as a sea monster or a sea serpent. It was a very specific type. The word actually means dog-headed sea dragon. And this is what Jesus said that Jonah spent the three nights in the belly of this beast, a particularly large one, apparently. It's just over the years, these dog-headed sea dragons went extinct, and so people weren't just kind of forgot about that. And it was translated in the Wycliffe Bible initially as you get the word whale, and it would that's been promulgated all throughout the ages since then, the King James and other modern-day ones. But some of the modern-day, I don't have the slide here, some of them do translate what in Jonah the word as sea monster specifically. I think a few of them are good. We're like ESV gets it wrong. The NASB gets it right, and the New Legacy Standard Bible that John MacArthur puts out, he gets it right. They just translated it as sea monster. So it was a real creature, just not a fish or a whale. If you come to the creation class the IBI class we do, I get into more detail with this. There's not enough time today. Yeah. Now, there are evidence of dinosaurs interacting with humans. I wanted to get through a little bit of this. Like, for instance, at Kachina Bridge, Utah, this is a petroglyph on the wall. Looks like a sauropod with a really long tail, they found. Another one that I really like is there's a mural that the Mayans made of them sacrificing people because they did that a lot. And there's people down here wearing various animal heads on them, but then they're recognizable. Some of them are like a leopard and there was a fish. But then look at what this guy's wearing. And that looks a lot like what could be a Deinonychus. Deinonychus is a creature, if you ever saw Jurassic Park, the velociraptors, that was really the Deinonychus. It's just they call them velociraptors because that's a cooler name. But yeah, that obviously looks more like a dinosaur than any living creature we have today. And if you look at these closer, you can see this. They drew pretty accurate depictions of the animals. So we know this was not some sort of fantastic like artist depiction. This was actually a creature and he was wearing as a head. In England, the tomb in Carlisle Cathedral in England, there's a bishop buried in the floor there, Richard Bell. All around his floor are in brass are carved these various animals. And some of them you can see a dog, some of there's a bat or whatever. One of these slides, there's these two creatures with their it's kind of worn off here, but they've got their necks interlocked, like they're kind of wrestling or doing something. But they look like what you would think of sauropods, like a apatosaurus or something like that. And they can actually be even identified to the species because of the weird stuff on this one's tail. These were Shunosaurus and Vulcanodon that they're depicting. Now, what's funny about this is that most of the time this is covered up by a rug in the cathedral. So you don't get to see it much. But they're evidence of dinosaurs. In other words, in France, every French king had animals that they liked to use to depict themselves and like, this is my spirit animal or whatever. Francois I, he loved what they call salamanders. And he had them depicted everywhere. He built castles and stuff. Here's a few examples of them. This one is the Chateau de Chambord. Pardon my pronunciation. But the look at the distinct scales in this thing. Very distinctive looking, and it's breathing fire. The scales look exactly like some of the fossils are good enough. You can see what the dinosaur skin looked like. This looks exactly like an animal known as Edmontosaurus, depicted here. Another one of his castles, you can see a lot of varied depictions. Here's one right here, could be a Plateosaurus or something different. The scales look different on this animal. This one has a ridge going along its back, and the scales are depicted differently than this. These are more rounded, these are more like polygonal. Above a fireplace is another depiction of this animal. It looks, again, these are salamanders, is what they're called. Yes?
What year was Francois's reign?
Oh, gosh. I want to say 15 or 1600. Okay. I don't know. It's the top of my head. Yeah.
Well, aren't there kind of animals look like that in the Java Islands?
They do. But modern... But
they don't breathe fire.
No. They have poisonous venom that make you feel like you're on fire.
But I mean, it's shaped.
Shaped like that. But Europeans at this time would have not known about the Komodo dragons. Another one I like just to prove that these weren't just kind of crazy people depicting stuff. sketch of Leonardo da Vinci. Again, one of these things is not like the other. This is a doodle of him drawing various cats. But do you see anything that does not look like a cat or weird artistic representations of them? Yeah. Yeah, he made a little cat-sized dragon. And it's just there as if it was a normal animal that he knew about. This is Leonardo da Vinci. He did this doodle around either 1517 or 1518. No. There's so many more examples of this kind of stuff, but I just don't have time today for a few, except for this one. The St. George slaying the dragon is a famous one. It's depicted all over Europe, and it was always depicted as the dragons differently, basically stuff they knew about in the region. This one, it came from Barcelona, Spain. It's an altar cloth depicted him slaying this weird-looking thing here. The one that stands out is this creature's teeth. They're very bizarre-looking. They're kind of coming out of its mouth. But there's an animal that we know of that had teeth exactly like this called a Nothosaurus. And it would have been about this size. So this is St. George slaying a Nothosaurus. A few others in the country of Mali in Africa. Here's somebody riding what appears to be a Gripposaurus. And then in Cambodia, Angkor Wat, it's a huge temple, the largest religious building on the planet. And they have depictions of various animals carved in all sorts of places, including this one. What does this look like? Stegosaur. So there were stegosaurs around there in Cambodia. What I wanted to get to also, kind of going back to the fossils and how things had to be buried quickly, is what we call the dinosaur death pose. A lot of times when they find dinosaurs, especially ones like this, you'll find them in a very unnatural position. The head is thrown back, the hind limbs are bent, and the tail is extended. They've experimented with birds who have a similar body type. I'm not saying birds came from dinosaurs, but some of these, the two-legged and whatever, shown that the only explanation for what can do this is what's known as death throes. This would be caused by muscle spasms resulting from severe malfunction of the central nervous system due to asphyxiation. Meaning these creatures were actually buried alive. They were not dead and just waited for the sediment to cover them. This is actually them going, their muscles spasming out as they were asphyxiated by the sediment. And you see this all over the place. Here's a Strithiomimus, a Cynosorceptorix, and an Archaeopteryx, which is an interesting creature. It may not have been a dinosaur at all, probably a weird, really weird bird, but an example. But you see this commonly found. It's just these animals were quickly buried alive. They cannot overtake what was coming for them, showing that they were buried quickly. Now, for the rest of this talk, I just kind of want to get into theology and faith, move around away from the science, and showing how creation can be affect a person in this way. 13 major Christian doctrines can actually be found in Genesis in one way or the other. Anybody who's taken systematic theology might recognize these. We have bibliology, theology proper, Christology, pneumatology, angelology proper, satanology, demonology, anthropology, hamartiology, soteriology, Israelology, ecclesiology, and eschatology. Not all in Genesis 1 through 11, but in the book of Genesis proper. You could find bits of all these different theological aspects in the book of Genesis. Very important book. So Genesis can add a lot of important questions that can be answered in there, like, where did the concept of the week come from? Every measurement of time we have is astronomically related. A year is the Earth going around the sun. A day is the Earth rotating on itself. A month is more or less the phases of the moon. A week doesn't make any sense. It's because God made it at the beginning. The concept of the week is from the creation day, and all the cultures remembered that. 7 days. If you're wondering about seconds and minutes, that comes from a weird... the Assyrians and other Mesopotamia, they had a base 60 number system, which gets us, they try to divide the days, but it's still fractions of a day, which is astronomical. Genesis can also answer the question, why do we wear clothes? Why are there governments, and what are they actually supposed to do? You can see that in God after the flood in the Noahic covenant. How many races are there? I know this. Can anyone answer that question? One. The human race. did mankind ever live in harmony with mosquitoes? Yes. Before the flood, before the fall, mosquitoes did not suck blood. And fun fact, it's only the females that do that.
You did have to add that, didn't you?
There's other questions like that, et cetera. Genesis can answer a bunch of important questions that you might not think about in a cursory reading of it. On a personal level, creation science could give one a much more robust faith. Because what we hear as truth inside the church and then out in the world, especially today, is so different from one another. Many Christians, you get equipped a lot of times in the church to even in less biblically, like churches that don't hammer like expository like we do have. You know what I'm saying? We do it. We have it so good here at Emmanuel. But even most Christians can reflexively process the dichotomy when it comes to like things like religion. We know this doesn't match up with Jesus and all that, so it's wrong. But they don't, not so much with science and history. There's a lot of doubts in there. That creates a cognitive dissonance that without people realizing it, they might truly believe in and accept Christ as their Savior, but they also might accept the Big Bang or evolution as true just because it's what they've been taught and they haven't given it too much thought, even though those things are completely contradictory to each other. This person, they may not realize what's happening, and that can lead to a feeling of unease deep in the back of their mind that just festers there for a while. But awareness that the Bible really can be trusted in anything, science and history, can relieve this conflict. You can trust Jesus. I took this quote from the song, "Oh Lord, and Lord, haste the day when my face shall be sight." Horatio Spafford, I'm going to take Horatio Spafford out of context here. But it's probably not what he had in mind when he wrote those, but when you see just how much overwhelming evidence there is for what God done, in a way, your faith can become deeper and it becomes more akin to knowledge. In Hebrews 11:1, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Now, the conviction part is the true thing. We still, we don't see Jesus, obviously, but you could be convinced of Jesus from the evidence that we see around here. Around of God, that God's word is true. In other words, 2 Peter 1:2, Peter really liked this kind of thing. Grace and peace be multiplied to you through the knowledge of God and Jesus our Lord. And then 2 Peter 1:5, for this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue and virtue with knowledge. We don't have a blind faith. God wants us to know things, understand them, and learn about him more. And this is what creation science is all about. But what I do want to posit here is, as important as it is, it's not salvific. You can completely believe in Genesis, but not believe in Christ. And also, you can have saving faith in Christ, but not take God at his word in the book of Genesis. But it can be used as a powerful tool for evangelism. For instance, you can appeal to Muslims with it. They have creation in the Quran as well. It's very similar to what's in the Bible, but they have a distorted version of it. Some of it makes no sense if you read it. And then a great example of how creation can be used for evangelism is Paul. In Acts 17, he gives this speech at Athens. Just like our culture today, he found himself in a city that had very, very little biblical knowledge, unlike where he grew up. Knowing where he had surrounded by Jews, they knew the Bible very well. Athens, not so much. And so if you read his sermon there, he started from the very, very beginning of creation because they needed that. And this is where our culture is today. Unlike in the past, many today in our culture here either don't believe in God or believe that if God exists, he'll just let them into heaven. But they know that God so loved the world, but they don't know the rest of the stuff, like his holiness. For instance, and so the New Testament, while very vitally important, obviously, it's got to be presented in its proper context, because the context is now unknown to our culture, unlike in the past. How do you even define what sin is if you don't know where sin came from? And that's like the book of Genesis. Additionally, it's so important for children and youth to be able to have answers when they're presented with this kind of thing in school or elsewhere, contradictory to what's in the Bible. Because small doubts can easily become large doubts if you allow them to just percolate. Resources, I just want to point out, the Answers in Genesis Emmanuel Bible Institute class. Myself and two other men, Trevor Specht and Jim Smithers, teach that. We teach it about once a year. The next one's coming up this fall. Jim Smithers, he would be here today, but he's actually presenting something on behalf of the three of us at the International Conference of Creationism that is going on right now. It happens once every 5 years. It's kind of a big deal. It's fun. So that's a good resource if you want to learn more. We go for like 14 weeks in that class. The two best websites, I think, to get this information and much more, answersingenesis.org and creation.com. Those are the two you want to go to. They trust them. You can read their statement of faith. They line up with the manual. They have so much information on there. And then you can ask me for book recommendations on any subtopic that you can think of. I could probably think of a book for it. And that's it. Thank you. Yes.